Good evening. The UN grapples with aiding more than a million Syrian refugees. Trump's plan to crush protesters was the military in on it, and another way to get Trump's taxes. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, July 10th, 2020. The Roman Catholic Church used an unprecedented exemption from federal rules to amass at least $1.4 billion in taxpayer-backed coronavirus aid. Millions went to churches that paid huge settlements or sought bankruptcy protection because of clergy sexual abuse cover-ups. Religious organizations aren't usually eligible for money from the U.S. Small Business Administration, but the CARES Act expanded eligibility to nonprofits, and Small Business Administration rules ensure participation by religious groups. And President Tayyip Erdogan declared Istanbul's Hagia Sophia open to worshippers on Friday. A top court ruled illegal the ancient building's conversion to a museum by Kemal Atatürk, modern Turkey's founding statesman. A Turkish government spokesperson says reopening Hagia Sophia as a mosque would not prevent people from visiting the World Heritage Site. Built in 537 AD under the rule of the Eastern Roman Empire, the church was the seat of the Orthodox Patriarch of Constantinople. The city was conquered by the Ottomans in the 15th century, and the church became a mosque. China says it will take reciprocal measures after Washington imposed sanctions on senior Chinese officials over alleged human rights abuses against the Uyghur Muslim minority. Senator Marco Rubio sponsored legislation signed by Trump in June calling for sanctions. It was reported last month China was trying to slash birth rates among Uyghurs with forced birth control. China denounced the report as fabricated. And Russia and China used their veto at the United Nations Security Council today to block a measure to keep open two border crossings between Turkey and Syria used by aid agencies. It was a short meeting.
The voting procedure for the draft resolution was launched on July 9, 2020 and concluded today on July 10th. In accordance with the special written procedure agreed by council members as set out in the letter from the president of the Security Council dated 27 March 2020, /2020-253. The result of the voting is as follows. 13 votes in favor, 2 votes against, no abstentions. The draft resolution has not been adopted owing to the negative vote of 2 permanent members of the council. The meeting is adjourned.
The Security Council is expected to continue debating a compromise measure proposed by Russia. There are about 4 million people being supported by UN assistance in Syria. 1.3 million are in an area supplied by the two border crossings from Turkey being disputed by the Security Council. Russia wants just one of what were originally 4 checkpoints to remain open. A Russian commentator on RT America today says there's plenty of aid for the refugees, but the United States is using the checkpoints to smuggle arms to forces opposed to Assad.
In the area is opposition forces are concentrated, opposition to current president of Syria. And that is the main reason why they want to supply them with, as they put it, humanitarian goods. But we've been witnessing a lot of disguising of humanitarian goods and a lot of cheating. Everything is done in order to overthrow the legitimate president of Syria.
And the United States has bitterly criticized the Russian government's involvement in Syria and imposed numerous sanctions. An aid group, Physicians for Human Rights, is a New York-based NGO. Ryan Kochi is the group's Middle East and North Africa researcher. He says outside aid is desperately needed in northern Syria.
It was challenged recently in basically December of 2019 by Russia. And in January of 2020, it was reduced in scope. So instead of 4 border crossings feeding into Syria, it was reduced to 2 border crossings feeding from Turkey into northwest Syria. What we're seeing now is basically an attempt to further reduce the scope of this extremely important mechanism. And what seems to be actually beyond that, an attempt to completely dismantle that mechanism. The country, the population, is dealing with the threat of COVID-19. It is in the midst of the worst currency and economic crisis in its history, and in need of every lifeline there is.
I thought the war is coming to an end anyway.
The war, I mean, it's certainly kinetically, let's say its intensity has been reduced over the past 2 years, and it's mainly because of territorial gains by the Syrian government and its supporters, including the Russian Federation and other nations and non-government armed groups. To say that the war is over, probably not. It is shifting. It is becoming another type of conflict. Of course, the humanitarian needs are not over. What we've seen between April of 2019 and March of 2020, we saw a push by the Syrian government and the Russian Federation and their allies to retake northwestern Syria, so one of the last rebel-held areas of the country. And that military campaign basically displaced millions of individuals further north, closer to the Turkish border, and drastically expanded humanitarian needs in those areas. That campaign was suspended since March by a ceasefire that is still holding, and we hope that it will continue holding. So this is all to say that in areas that the government controls and in areas that the government does not control, humanitarian needs are not being met fully. They're actually growing broader and deeper, and they need to be addressed through every channel possible.
So the Russians and the Chinese or Russia think that this aid is going to help people hold out longer?
So I wouldn't say hold out longer. I think
From their perspective,
it's support going to the Syrian government. So whatever they can do to centralize even humanitarian aid in Damascus, they will do. We saw them chipping away at this mechanism that is outside of the control of Damascus.
What about the Trump administration? What are they doing about this?
Within the Security Council, the United States has not been supportive of the Russian position in the least, on Syria at least. The Syrian people here could use all the support they can get. But the problem is, even with the American position, supporting the reauthorization of three border crossings, the renewal for 12 months, and the continuation of this important humanitarian mechanism, the Russians can still thwart the entire scheme. It's important for member states to continue negotiating in good faith. Millions of people are affected by this. Between the Northwest and the Northeast, we're talking about an estimated population of 4 million and beyond. And these are individuals who have been displaced multiple times. These are individuals who fully depend on life-saving humanitarian aid, on food trucked in from Turkey and from Iraq, on health equipment also brought in across the border, on services being provided by non-governmental organizations that are delivered through funding tied to this mechanism, on logistical support by agencies that are also attached to this mechanism. Millions of lives are in the balance here, and we need to be very aware of that when we're discussing the politics of this resolution and of the mechanism.
Ryan Kochi is Middle East and North Africa researcher for the aid group Physicians for Human Rights. And the COVID-19 epidemic continues to overwhelm hospitals, states, and nations around the world. The WHO reports almost 12 million cases worldwide and more than 545,000 deaths from the disease. The United States has more than 3 million cases confirmed, peaking yesterday at about 60,000 new cases. While New York and New England have seen a reduction, dangerous surges are occurring throughout the South and West. Testing is a big problem. The New York Times reports the U.S. is only conducting 39% of the testing it needs, with Arizona doing worse in testing among the states. And the World Health Organization is setting up an independent panel to review its handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark and former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf have agreed to head the panel. WHO says the review is not linked to criticism by the United States of its response in the early days of the pandemic. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. President Trump ignored the coronavirus surge in Florida today as he visited the U.S. Southern Command headquarters in Doral. He was there for a counter-narcotics briefing. While sitting behind a table stacked with seized drugs, Trump laid into the defund the police movement, claiming it'll never happen.
We stand with the incredible men and women of law enforcement. We will never, ever defund our police, okay? That I can tell you. We're not defunding police. You know, what's going on here, Admiral, when you hear defund the police, you're probably saying that's a foreign language, right? So just a terrible thing, but it's I assume this is going to be a fad. We'll call it a fad, but it's not something that will work very well, that I can tell you.
Trump spoke mostly about Venezuela, accusing the country's leaders of narcotics trafficking without much evidence. Yesterday, the House Armed Services Committee held hearings into the use of the military to suppress peaceful protests after the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officer. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, and Defense Secretary Mark Esper were on the hot seat. Both said no military forces were used against protesters and that the National Guard in Washington, D.C. was told to hang back as police attacked peaceful protesters in Lafayette Park. The questioning veered into military bases named after Confederate officers during the Civil War. General Milley said he's considering a name change.
Definitely think that the original decisions to name those bases after Confederate generals, the 10 bases you're talking about in the Army, those were political decisions back in the 1910s and 20s and 30s and World War I, World War II time, for 100 years ago. And they're going to be political decisions today. The military equity here is divisiveness. And as you mentioned, cohesion. 43% of the United States military are minorities. In the Army, for example, and these are Army bases you're talking about, we're up to 20+% African-American, and in some units you'll see 30%. And for those young soldiers that go on to a base, a Fort Hood or a Fort Bragg or a Fort wherever named after a Confederate general, they can be reminded that that general fought for an institution of slavery that may have enslaved one of their ancestors. I had a staff sergeant when I was a young officer who actually told me that at Fort Bragg. And he said he went to work every day on a base that represented a guy who enslaved his grandparents. So the symbols of the, it's not just that, you know, we have to improve the substance of promotions, et cetera, in the military. But we've also got to take a hard look at the symbology, the symbols. Things like Confederate flags and statues and bases and all that kind of stuff. The Confederacy, the American Civil War, was fought. And it was an act of rebellion. It was an act of treason at the time against the Union, against the Stars and Stripes, against the U.S. Constitution. And those officers turned their back on their oath. Some have a different view of that. Some think it's heritage. Others think it's hate. The way we should do it matters as much as that we should do it. So we need to have, I've recommended a commission of folks to take a hard look at the bases, the statues, the names, all of this stuff, to see if we can have a rational.
General Mark Milley speaking yesterday in front of the House Armed Services Committee. President Trump has vowed to never allow a name change. He said today he thought it would be unlucky since the bases were involved in wars the United States had won. And in a chilling moment during the hearing, New Jersey Democrat Mickey Schirill asked both Esper and Milley if they understood the president's sole power to make them do anything he wanted, even if they disagreed.
Given the attempts at politicizing our military and the unorthodox way the president attempted to control troops in our nation's capital, I want to discuss some of the legal underpinnings of civilian control. Because I have such a short period of time, I'm looking for a yes or no. If you don't know the answer, please just let me know. You'll take it for action. Secretary Esper and General Milley, you've both testified that you have taken oaths to the Constitution of the United States. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that oath includes an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and bear true faith and allegiance to the same, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
And are you both aware that Article 2 of the Constitution states that the executive power shall be vested in a president, in other words, one or a single president?
Yes.
Yes.
And are you both aware that Article 2 of our Constitution makes the president the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States?
Yes. Yes.
And Secretary Esper, are you aware that the President's power to remove office cabinet officials from key national security positions, including the Secretary of Defense, is undisputed?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Certainly. Are you aware that the President's power to remove from office key cabinet officials, especially in national security positions, including the Secretary of Defense, is undisputed?
Yes.
And General Milley, are you aware that the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which applies to all uniformed officers, criminalizes mutiny and sedition and soliciting or advising on the commission of mutiny or sedition?
Absolutely. Yes.
And Secretary Esper, are you aware of the fundamental proposition that the Secretary of Defense is selected by the legitimate president?
Yes, and confirmed by the Senate.
And that the legitimate commander-in-chief is the one who oversees the chain of command, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
So finally, the Insurrection Act states that whenever the president considers that unlawful obstructions, combinations, or assemblages, or rebellion against the authority of the United States makes it impracticable to enforce the laws of the United States in any state by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, he may call into federal service such of the militia of any state and use such of the armed forces as he considers necessary to enforce those laws or to suppress rebellion. Yes?
Yes.
And that's Representative Mickey Sherrill questioning Secretary of Defense Mark Esper and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Mark Milley. The incident that prompted yesterday's hearing by the House Armed Services Committee occurred on June 1st. Trump ordered National Park Police and troops from the District of Columbia National Guard and some other federal law enforcement agencies to drive peaceful protesters from Lafayette Square north of the White House, clearing the way for his now infamous Bible-thumping photo op. The same day, Trump and his Attorney General William Barr, along with Defense Secretary Mark Esper, also placed a call to the nation's 50 governors. In a leaked transcript, Trump and Barr referred in glowing terms to the way the Obama administration, almost 9 years earlier, had crushed the months-long Occupy movement across the country in a matter of a few days. Journalist Dave Lindor, founder of ThisCan'tBeHappening.org, has been following the story and the government's potential abuse of its spying power against peaceful protesters.
After the attack on the protesters outside Lafayette Square Park, that he was going to use the Occupy model to put down what they called riots around the country, he's referring to the fact the Occupy movement was crushed by violent police actions in all the cities where they had Occupy encampments, orchestrated by the Homeland Security Department under Obama. That model was to declare the Occupy movement to be a terrorist action, a terrorist conspiracy. You had the FBI, you had all the fusion centers, a linking of all the intelligence agencies at every level, Defense Department, FBI, Federal Protection Service, state police intelligence, the local police intelligence services. They all work through these fusion centers in a very amorphous way and no transparency at all. And then the Joint Terrorist Task Forces, which try to link all of these things as terrorism, now they're doing the same thing. The model is to declare the uprisings around the country to be a terrorist action. And what we see is that the FBI is tailing the police when they go to the homes of activists in the various city uprisings, and they join in the questioning. And that's extremely dangerous, because when you lie to a FBI agent, it's a federal crime. So when people are questioned, they have to be doubly careful what they do if there's an FBI agent there.
There's been a groundswell of people saying that we do have a domestic terrorism problem from the right wing, yet the government has refused to move to declare right-wingers, Nazis and other movements of similar ilk as terrorists, yet they're so quick to do it on the left, it seems.
In the case of Occupy, and for the most part in these uprisings now, you have a real strong commitment to nonviolence. They're basically trying to look for something that's not there. During the Occupy movement, there was a document I got a hold of through the Partnership for Civil Justice that was a memo from the FBI Houston office to the National FBI office saying that a known blank organization with identified members was conducting intelligence on the Occupy movement with an eye to finding out who the leaders were so that they could use suppressed rifle fire to assassinate the leaders of the Occupy movement in Houston. That document I obtained a year after the Occupy movement had been crushed, and I called the FBI and said, both in Houston and in Washington, and said, well, where were the arrests for this terrorist plot? And the answer I got from the head of their media office was, well, if it were serious, something would have been done. That's not the way the FBI has handled all its other terrorist prosecutions. They bust people like in Cleveland with these cockamamie supposed schemes and send them to jail. But not in this particular case, which sounded very, very real, the way it was described by the FBI office in Houston. It's all very serious stuff. Calling something a terrorist operation makes it so that if they concoct a conspiracy thing out of these, you know, harassments of people, you're talking about a lot of years in jail.
From these kind of investigations, are you going to see?
I did talk with the head of the Partnership for Civil Justice, Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, and also the head of the National Lawyers Guild, Pooja Gehi, and they both warned that the likelihood is the FBI is going to try to concoct some kind of conspiracy thing that they can bring to trial to get a lot of negative publicity about the uprisings.
Even if there is a not guilty verdict, it doesn't matter. It's the act of arresting and the trial and that kind of publicity is all they need.
And it also acts to intimidate people. So the best thing is just people need to just go ahead with what they're doing. Be careful you don't talk to an FBI agent. Just don't do that. And if the police come to you, say you need a lawyer. You have a right to a lawyer.
Journalist Dave Lindorf, founder of ThisCan'tBeHappening.org. And yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that the Manhattan District Attorney and U.S. Congress can proceed with attempts to get President Trump's long-held tax returns. He was the first major party nominee since 1976 to refuse to release his tax returns. But even with the court's ruling, there's little hope the public will peruse the president's dependents and write-offs until well after the November election. But there might be one way to satiate the nation's need to see if Trump is really a billionaire. A New York state law, the Trust Act, passed last year, was written by State Senator Brad Holyman. It allows his state taxes to be turned over to Congress if they ask.
There is widespread concern among my constituents and I think among New Yorkers that there is the lack of transparency has potentially led to conflicts of interest.
Now, this wouldn't apply to his federal taxes.
Yes, it's state tax returns, but you get a perspective on the federal taxes, too. Look, why hasn't Congress asked for these returns? Why haven't they utilized the New York state law? Why have they tried to take this all the way to the Supreme Court and once again have been effectively rebuffed to the extent that we're not going to be able to see Trump's taxes before the election? To me, this is governmental malpractice. The state of New York has given the Congress, Richard Neal, who's chair of the Ways and Means Committee, an opportunity to request and receive Trump's state taxes, but they've refused to do it. It really boggles the mind why they have not pursued this avenue. I fought long and hard for this bill, and it's really discouraging, to say the least, that our Democratic-led members of Congress do not request these returns.
You can't just give it to them or send it to them in an envelope, a brown paper envelope, or just give it to the Daily News or something like that?
No, the state law that we passed requires that congressional tax investigating committees, whether it's the Ways and Means Committee, the Senate Finance Committee, or the Joint Committee on Taxation, to actually request by letter the taxes of any public official elected or appointed in the state of New York for a intended purpose.
Now, what about Cyrus Vance? Can't he get it this way?
Well, he's getting it this way through his subpoena power. But once again, we don't know when we'll see those taxes. Certainly Congress, which should have oversight authority over the executive branch, isn't going to have automatic access to these taxes. The governmental role of Congress and its oversight responsibility is not going to be satisfied through the subpoena power by the Manhattan District Attorney. I consider that a win, but I don't think that it helped me resolve, in my mind, those issues of balance of power and the appropriate role of Congress to request the taxes of the President of the United States.
Some folks have said that one thing oversight is another thing to be a prosecutorial agency and to go fishing for evidence to use to prosecute the President in the halls of Congress.
It is a legitimate use of their power, and I believe it is, to provide a check over the executive has the right to request the taxes of a sitting president. They have done so. They have received a yellow light, not a green light, from the Supreme Court because the case is being remanded. They are not going to see the taxes in time for when it matters, which is before November. That's why it's important that we urge all of our members, Democratic members of Congress, to get with the program and request Trump's state taxes, as New York State has provided them the vehicle to do so.
And that's State Senator Brad Holyman. He represents Greenwich Village and parts of the Lower East Side. And that's some of the news for Friday, July 10th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Hold on one second. This week, the news had help from Sharon Willems and Aaron Kay. If you have any tips and comments, please address them to paulnews@wbai.org. paulnews@wbai.org for tips and comments about the WBAI News. Thanks for joining us.